Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
All right, I'm here with Becky Sloviter. Hello, Becky.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you. We've known each other for so long, and I'm just so excited to talk about your movie Palm Springs and everything else, because it's come up quite a bit on my podcast, that movie, because it is just a great example of somebody going out and doing something really creative and exciting on their own and being very well rewarded for it. So congratulations on that movie and the exciting record-breaking sale. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I know I've told you this before, but your podcast is really one of my favorites. So I'm truly delighted to be on with you.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad you're here. So let's walk through how you got to Palm Springs, and then we can dive into that a little bit more in detail. But what I want to talk to you about is you are one of those rare people that have been an agent and a producer and an executive and an executive at a financing company and an executive at a studio and then back to being a producer again.
A long and winding road. Yes.
You've had a long and winding road. And in the middle of that, I'm assuming after your MGM job, you were a stay-at-home mom for 3 years. So that's also unusual. So walk me through, was your first job at Endeavor as an agent, or just walk me through kind of how you got into the business and what inspired you?
Sure. You know, I grew up in Abington, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb right outside of Philadelphia, and just always loved movies and TV, and I think loved it a little more than everyone else seemed to, and had, you know, an early subscription to Premiere magazine, and was always really fascinated by the behind the scenes of filmmaking, and just was somewhat of a student of it. My dad was a big movie buff, and we would watch, he would show me classics like Some Like It Hot or It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Those are still two of my favorites of all time. And I think that was also a good primer for me in terms of my love of comedy.
Yeah.
But I never really thought about doing this as a career. And then I went to college in Washington, D.C. at GW, George Washington University. And I was always really interested in politics, kind of obsessed with Watergate. And this was the mid-90s, which at this point now feels kind of quaint considering where things are. But it was a great time to be there. And so I worked in the White House. I was an intern in 1995 in the White House. My family likes to joke I was the other Jewish brunette intern in the White House in 1995. So I worked there, and then I interned with Ted Kennedy. And by the time I was a sophomore in college, I was kind of jaded, and the bureaucracy and red tape of politics was a bit of a turnoff even in those days. So I moved back to Philadelphia after I graduated college and was there for a few years working at University of Pennsylvania and not really, just trying to figure it out. You know, I was working in what they call development. It's a different kind of development than you and I do, but it was fundraising basically. And what happened to me, there were sort of three things in quick succession that happened that brought me out to Hollywood. And the first was I had moved back to Philadelphia for the boy that I was dating at the time, and we broke up. And so I was a little less tethered there. And then I went to New York for a conference among Ivy League schools that Columbia was hosting. And I happened to be there on September 11th. Which was sort of a surreal experience, of course, But, you know, I think for so many people, whether you were there that day or not, it was such a moment of, oh, life is fleeting. Like, this could all actually be over tomorrow.
Yeah.
So let me do what is this dream that I have, this glint in my eye of, could I ever work in the movie business? You know, I didn't know anyone in the business. It felt like such a long shot, but there was almost an emboldening or an empowerment coming out of this experience of September 11th, you know, of I have to try it. I will regret it if I don't. And so it was kind of creeping up a little bit more for me. And then the final thing was, and I know this is kind of silly, but I, as I said, I listen to your podcast all the time and I like hearing the background from other guests talking about what their motivations were or inspiration. And for me, I went by myself to see the Royal Tenenbaums. And there's that moment where Gwyneth Paltrow is getting off the bus to see Luke Wilson and everything gets really quiet. And that incredible Nico song comes on and I just start to cry. And when the movie ends, I sat there in the theater by myself and thought, I'm never going to care about anything the way I care about movies and TV. I have to go. I have to try. So I sent, you know, as I said, I was always reading Premiere magazine and knowing a little bit about the business. So I sent my resume and cover letter to what I knew were the five major talent agencies at the time, and CAA, ICM, Endeavor, William Morris, and UTA. And I flew out, I saved up all my airline miles, I interviewed at Endeavor and a few of the other places, but Endeavor said, we don't have anything for you now, but call me the first, I'll never forget this, Carol Katz, who was the great head of human resources for Endeavor and then WME for many years, said, I don't have anything for you, but if you call me the first week of June, I will see if I can get you in. And I called Monday, June 3rd at 9:10 a.m. I didn't want it to seem crazy and call right at 9 o'clock. So just a little crazy calling at 9:10. And she said, yes, if you come out here, there's a spot in the mailroom for you. So moved out here July 4th, 2002. Wow. And started Endeavor a couple days later.
Well, congratulations on your anniversary of being here.
Yeah,
since this is now July. What do you think? It must have been a crazy resume for them to get because you had so much experience in politics. What did you ever ask? What do you think it was in terms of your resume that got her attention?
You know, it's interesting. And I think this is something that, and because I know, you know, so many college kids or people who are trying to get into the industry listen to your podcast too. And I think what's always so helpful is when you're talking to your guests, you know, anything that's kind of a truism about hard work or work ethic. Carol definitely looked at my resume and thought, huh? And then it really became so much about working hard and taking it seriously. You know, she could see in my eyes I was coming either way, and maybe I would work here and maybe I would work somewhere else. And then that was really the energy that I brought with me to the mailroom. You know, I had left everything behind in Philadelphia. I didn't know a soul here. And I was just here to, as they say, keep my head down and do the work. So I was in the mailroom for a couple of weeks. And again, just kind of hustling and like, what can I do? What can I learn? Who can I observe? And Carol came in and said, I need to talk to you, and pulled me out into the hallway and said, Ari Emanuel's second assistant is getting married and going on her honeymoon, and I need someone to fill in for her for 2 weeks, and it's going to be you. And Ari was, you know, he's a legend, obviously, and that was also just a great, I'm raised by Oprah, so I'm stealing this phrase from her, but I do think, you know, luck is preparation meets opportunity. So that was, again, just a, she could see how seriously I was taking it and put me right in the fire, as they say, which is a phenomenal experience. And then, as you know, I went to work for Phil Raskind after that and was with him for almost a year. And that was also just incredible experience. He, as you well know, because you've, you know, worked with him for so many years, he had his fingers in everything. You know, there he would talk to heads of studios like you. He would talk to the CE who had just been promoted. He dealt with absolutely everything. And as you know, agencies are really the nucleus of the business, where every single strand basically runs through them. So it was also just an incredibly great training ground for me there.
It's so great because so many people think like you have to know a ton of people. You have to have gone to film school. You have to like know, you know, everything about the movie business when you get in. And you're a testament to you had an entirely different career, but you were single-minded and focused, and you were going to work hard and you were not going to be denied. And therefore, the people that, you know, make those decisions of hiring people at that level saw that and saw, like, even though you didn't have the quote unquote movie or film experience, but you definitely had life experience, and they could tell that you were going to make a difference in their organization. And I think that's so empowering and so inspiring, because if you are a person who's, you know, not a teenager coming right out of film school, you can make that change. And you needed the giant kick in the ass of 9/11 to really show you that life is short and precious. And also then the combination of being inspired creatively by the Royal Tenenbaums. It's such a great story, because I am of the mind, as you know, that you only need to know one person at most to get into the business. And if you just work hard and are not going to be denied, the walls are not that tall.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think there's so many steps to that, right? So when I got out here, as you know, I've shared with you, that was how I made my first inroads. But then, you know, then what? So I was working for Phil. And again, he was an incredible mentor to me. Adriana was so good to me. Tom Strickler, they all really took me under their wing. But I actually didn't want to be an agent. And they offered to promote me on the spot when I told them this. And, you know, I was an agent trainee at the time. But I was also, you know, if not single-minded about it, I knew what I didn't want to do, which I often think, as you're, you know, going about any career, figuring out what works for you is as valuable as figuring out what doesn't.
Right.
So for me, it just wasn't, for both lifestyle reasons, and I didn't really think my skill set was in being an agent. So, you know, to be at Endeavor at that time, though, this was 2002 and 2003, it was such a familial environment at the time. You know, once a month, all of the entire company at that point, it was small, that we could all gather in that 10th floor conference room once a month. And if you were an assistant getting promoted to agent trainee, or if you were an agent trainee getting promoted to agent, you would give a speech. And actually, Phil Raskind would be rating you. He would bring a buck slip in and, you know, 8-4 because the dismount was bad or whatever it was. It was just, it was a fun time. You really felt like you were a part of something.
And that's sorry to interrupt you. And that's also the time, it was so small that they used to do very cool, funny, fun things to announce promotions of people that were becoming agents. Whether it be like balloons being delivered or something, a window washer coming down, or your mom walking in. There was just, I remember every time there would be some fun announcement, they really put a lot of thought and care into it. It really was a small familial agency at the time.
I'm so grateful for the experience. And I think, you know, there's a few things, and we'll come back to some of them later in my story. But I think whenever, you know, a friend of my mom's nephew who's moving out here, and do you have 30 minutes to talk to them? You know, I will always talk to anyone, because I do very much believe in paying it forward. But also, my advice is always the same on one level: start at an agency. It just tells you, it's such a great primer, no matter what you want to do. You know, half the people I would say that to say, but I don't want to be an agent. And I was like, I get it. I didn't know if I did either. but the exposure you get, and also the crew of people that, you know, I was assistants with: Phil Damacourt, Matt Riley, Mike Balbo, Doug Luckerderhan, Brent Morley, Zach Drucker. You know, these were my people, and still are, you know, many, many, many years later. We help each other. There's a really nice familiarity. It's just, I have so much affection for being there at that time. But again, so Phil loves to tell the story. We were going to promote her on the spot. She's crazy to turn us down. But he and Strickler were really, they were great mentors. And they said, okay, if you don't want to be an agent, you need to go do one of three things. Go work for a big producer, a big director, or the head of a studio. And so I was kind of just biding my time. Great advice. Nothing was coming up. And then I got the opportunity to interview with Mary Parent, who was running Universal at the time with Stuber. And then I went there in the fall of 2003 to work for her, which was the most incredible experience, really probably the best job I've ever had.
She's amazing. And that was a great partnership with Mary and Scott. And you were there right around the time Role Models was made, right? Is that when you were there?
So I started a little earlier than that. So I went there to be Mary's assistant, and it was such a heyday. I mean, I'm sure you remember, but it was Meet the Fockers, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Born Supremacy, you know, the Fast and the Furious franchise, Bruce Almighty. It was just, they were on fire, and they had this murderer's row of executives also that I got the opportunity to learn from. So it was Donna Langley, Holly Barrio, Dylan Clark, Matt Jackson, you know, Jimmy Horowitz. It was all these, you know, incredible people. And then, so I was her assistant for about a year and a half. And then she and Stuber were vice chairman. And then they segued into their producing deal that was based at Universal. And that's when we made Role Models. Right. Which was such an incredible experience, and also the first movie that I worked on really soup to nuts and got the experience of, okay, this is producing. Got
right.
it. You know?
And what was the biggest pivot you had to make from being in the agency to working at a production company of that stature?
That's a great question. It was, you know, it's funny because I do think there's skill sets that translate to any job. And then there's other things job to job that are specifically required of you that maybe you're, you know, not as seasoned in at first, but really get to be. But to me, so much was, it always comes back to me for hard work, but also instinct. A lot of the skills or traits or whatever it is that I applied to my time at Endeavor, I was applying to being a producer. It was just also the opportunity to learn from Mary and Scott was so formative for me. And I have to say, I still think about them all the time. I really have a, you know, how would they handle these things? What would the strategy be? And I think a lot of it, you know, as you well know, a lot of things with producing and also at an agency and also at a studio, whatever it is strategy. It is being anticipatory and just using logic, obviously, but there's so many cooks in every kitchen when you're making a movie, and you know the personalities involved. There's skills that, you know, I sometimes think my psychology degree from GW prepared me for more than anything in this town.
For sure. And it should be noted that Mary Parent now runs Legendary, and Scott Stuber now runs content for Netflix. So you learned from really, really, really smart, talented people that are mentioned quite a bit on this podcast. And so then you go from there, and you go did you go with Mary to MGM?
And then you
became an executive there. And then you is that when you have your child?
So first, yes, I was actually trying to think, Todd, when was the last time we saw each other? And I think it's when I was waddling in hugely, hugely pregnant to a postmortem after we had a zookeeper, one of the great test screenings on that movie.
Yeah.
So I went there with Mary in 2008 when she, you know, was really restarting the studio from scratch. Obviously, MGM is so legendary. And I'm so excited looking at what DeLuca and Pam are going to do there now, too. But it was just completely new and, you know, came in and nobody's better than Mary. So she knew, okay, I have to make some statements. So we had the huge spec sale for your Project Zookeeper. Among many others. And, you know, to be a VP at a studio was also a new and really valuable experience. You're just dealing with people on a different level. It's it was great. And, you know, we were really humming along for a while. And then MGM went through a bit of a weird time. And they were going through what was called, I think, a prepackaged bankruptcy at this time. And that dovetailed exactly with me being pregnant. And, you know, I had a baby and I just felt differently about everything, about the world. I had been coming off of, you know, close to 10 years at that point of kind of working truly around the clock and killing myself, but in a great way, in a way that I loved. And now I had something else that was hugely important to me and that needed, you know, my time. So it was an interesting moment. But yes, I had my first baby basically just as MGM was kind of dying a slow death.
And you took 3 years off. I mean, that's no joke. That's not like just a 3 month sabbatical. That's some real time. And during that 3 years, kind of what was going through your mind in terms of your coming back to the business? Did you miss it? What was the impetus for you coming back and specifically at that time?
Sure. So, you know, truthfully, when I decided to take time off, I was pregnant with my second kid. And then during those 3 years, as you know, you have kids. I mean, I was like picking applesauce out of my hair and didn't know what day or time it was most of the time. You know, it's funny because now we're all in a time loop and it's reminding me of those early newborn days more than anything. But so I wasn't giving a lot of thought to it in the moment. You know, the impetus for it really was I kind of had this existential career crisis of feeling not very fulfilled in my job. I wasn't at MGM anymore. I was at a small financier called Cross Creek. And, you know, it was challenging. A financier is very different than working at a studio. I had worked for Mary for 8 years at that point. You know, nobody's better than she is. Nobody's more varsity is how I kind of put it. And a lot of, you know, other places can seem very JV when you're used to that. So I was not really fulfilled or happy in my career. And I also felt like I was missing so much time with my kid. And so then when I was pregnant with my second kid, that's when I made the decision. You know, my husband Matt looked at me like I had 10 heads when I first brought it up. Like, we own our home in Los Angeles. You want to cut our income in half? Like, what? But I want you to be happy. And I know this is coming from a place of just, you know, wanting to be to mother in the way that I wanted to do it. So I also, having grown up in this business, all of my friends are in the business. So even when I was taking this time off, I was still, if not ensconced or immersed in it, I was still connected to it. You know, my closest friends are either agents or studio executives or my husband, who's a producer. So I was aware of the business and what was happening in it, but truthfully wasn't paying much attention. And then I started to have that itch to come back. I missed it, certainly, but I was home with two little tiny people and no help. So was not super focused. And then when my little one was starting preschool and I knew, okay, I'm going to have both kids out of the house for at least chunks of the day, it started to become more of a reality to me of being ready to come back. And so that was the end of 2015 when I came back. And that also, I will say, those three-ish years that I was out, the business had really shifted. You know, the business shifted, as we all know, after the writer strike of 08 and 09. And then what happened when I was ready to come back was a lot of my cohorts and sort of the people of my class were doing television And that was also intimidating and interesting. And I thought, okay, if I can get into maybe that aspect of the business, that would be fruitful. And so back to, again, the connections you make early in your career, Phil Damacourt, who I had been an assistant with at Endeavor, was really helpful to me and connected me with a financier called The Ink Factory. They had just made that miniseries, The Night Manager, for AMC, and that had been really successful for them, and they were looking for someone to run their LA office. So that was my first job back.
Wow. Welcome back. Also, another great lesson that, you know, it's not over just because you went and did that. Like, if, and there's people that have taken time off for all kinds of different reasons, to travel, to get and dip more education, to take care of their family, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're good, you always can come back. It's not like these career, it's just such a, it feels like sometimes that it's so black and white. Like, if you have one failed movie, you're never going to work again. If you take some time off, you're never going to work again. And it's just not true, especially if you're talented and you work hard like you do.
Thank you. And I couldn't agree with you more. I was just talking to a friend who's taking a little bit of time now with her kids. And she was saying, she was calling me sort of almost for therapy of like, you're the only person I know who ever did this. And how was it getting back to it? And, you know, this, the truth of that too, as I was saying to you in an email yesterday, is, you know, I had to claw my way back. It's not like when I decided to come back, anyone gave a shit. You know, they were like, okay, yeah, of course, we know you, we remember you, we always liked you, we don't have anything for you. You know, it was pretty cold and dark out there for certainly for a few months. The first, I will also say, just to be completely candid, the first interview I had back, I sat down, I'm in, you know, I've blown out my hair for the first time in what feels like years, I'm dressed, I'm ready. And the very first question that this guy asked me is, he's looking at my resume sort of with disdain and says, so what have you been doing for the past 3 years? And yeah, and I'm like I'm sitting straight as a board. And I don't flinch. And I say, I've been home with my kids. Like, I will not apologize for this. And also, I know I'm going to be kept being met with this. So, you know, it wasn't like I came back and was right in the nucleus again, like I'd been with Mary and Scott, but it was, you know, I'm really grateful for my time. I was at the Ink Factory for a year and then got a call from a buddy at UTA who said, would you want to run the Lonely Islands Company? And I was like, fuck yes.
Yeah.
I was such humongous fans of theirs, and the opportunity also, they had a deal at the time at 20th. So it was an opportunity to not just, you know, I'd learned a little bit about television when I was at the Ink Factory, but this was a, you know, real first look deal at a real television studio, and they had certain expectations, and there was a, you know, well, the sort of rhythm of development season and pilot season and all of that. So I went there at the beginning of 2017 and was dropped in the deep end and had to figure it out in terms of the TV of it all, but it was great.
I'm so grateful that in my television career have not had a broadcast show, because I still don't know what those development seasons are. I always seem to miss them. Like, every time I would come, I would wrap a movie in, you know, in March or April, and then I'd be like, okay, here we go. And like, you fucking missed it. What are you talking about? And they're like, all right, next year. It's gonna get it. I'm so grateful that there's this new Netflix and cable. I have two shows. I'm doing for Netflix right now. And I'm like, oh, I just sold those. I can't remember when I sold them. I sold them just like on a Tuesday. It wasn't that pilot season. That whole thing was so hard and so frustrating. I swear to you, it felt like people were doing like square dancing, and they're like, jump in. And I'm like, I don't know how to square dance. I don't know how to get in there.
It's so true. And it's also, you know, so much of producing television is so similar to producing movies, right? It's personality management, putting out fires, resource allocation, being anticipatory, all the things that make you a good producer. But there are also certain things where I have really clear memories. And what makes me laugh about this story is whenever I tell someone who only still does features, they also have the same reaction I had, which was, it's like my first week on the job there. I get sent a story area. I'm like, what the fuck is the story area? Got it. Okay. It's a page or two that's going to pre-outline, tell you what this episode's going to be about. And at the top of the story area, it said, this will be a bottle episode. So I'm like quickly texting my friend who's worked in television her whole career, like, what is a bottle episode? And of course, I'm sure most people know, but a bottle episode is an episode that takes place all in one location for the entirety of the episode. And oftentimes to save money in your budget for applying it to other episodes down the road. So, and then the next day, someone says something to me about, okay, well, we'll probably block shoot these episodes. And I'm like, again, texting my friend, what is block shooting? So there was certainly a learning curve for it. But man, I agree with you. The broadcast pilot season, it was fascinating, first of all, I would say, to witness. And then when I was at Party Over Here with the Lonely Island guys, we finished that deal at 20th and then got a deal with CBS Television Studios, which was really wonderful and very fruitful for us. And that was where I got a bit more insight into the, as you're referencing, you know, the craziness of pilot season. We had, with our mutual friend, Adam Stekiel, I had a pilot that we sold in the room to Channing Dungey, who left ABC like 5 minutes later. And then Jamila Hunter, who left about 10 minutes after that. And then one of our other executives left. So we had this like bidding war, bought in the room pilot. I was like, this is going to go. I finally did it. And everybody left and new regime came in. And so we never ended up making it. But that sort of stop and start of everything is, it's wild. It's such a roller coaster, those months of broadcast pilot season.
But again, it just goes to show you that you have talent in developing good characters, developing story. You have a good sense of humor. And that is applicable to any form of content. I mean, there's just so the lines are so blurred now,
yeah,
in terms of what is streaming, what is theatrical, what is network, what is cable. I mean, you know, what is streaming, like cable? It's like there's like Quibi. There's so many different,
yeah,
different ways to get your content across that it just is about telling good stories with good characters at the center of them.
I mean, exactly. That's always what is to me the guiding light. And I also find, you know, you do both movies and TV, so you know, a good writer is a good writer is a good writer. So to me, it's about seeking out working with the people that you believe in, that you have good relationships with, but also if, whether you know them or not, you read something, it's great. It doesn't matter what form it's in. You know, I am in, I know we'll talk about this in a bit, but in this new company that I'm launching, you know, I'm working a lot, even though it's solely features, I'm pulling on some of the relationships that I made in television, because nobody's better with character than writers from television who have to do it every week, multiple episodes a year, right. You know, and that's why people fall in love with these characters and think, yep, that they know them, you know?
So let's talk about your new company and let's talk about Palm Springs, because I loved it and I'm so excited that it got made. And for people who haven't seen it, it is a wonderful spin on the kind of Groundhog Day romantic comedy idea, but takes it in a completely new and fresh way. It's contained. It was done independently, yet has a real high concept with real stars. And, you know, even though it was made for an independent price, it looks like a big studio movie. And obviously it sold for $20+ million. So obviously you all were rewarded for that endeavor. So tell me how this came across your desk, and then tell me how tell me how you got it made, and then let's go all the way through the Sundance, and then we'll talk about your new company.
Okay, great. So I was at Party Over Here running the company, and Palm Springs actually came in to Andy Samberg, obviously one of the Lonely Island guys. It came into him to star, and he read it, he loved it. I loved it. He said, if I say yes to this, you'll produce it. Yes, yes, of course. And so that was the deal we made with our amazing screenwriter, Andy Ciara, and our director, Max Barbico, who had come up together at AFI. They were friends for a long time, had talked about working together on this movie. And so that's how it came to us. And so that's how we onboarded producing it. And I will
now
say,
it came, I'm sorry to interrupt you. It came just as a packaging thing from these guys that wanted to package it and see if Andy wanted to star in it. It wasn't set up anywhere. It didn't have financing yet. What shape was it in when it came to you?
Correct. It was naked, so to speak, other than Max was attached to direct and Andy had written this incredible script. And it had just gone to Andy's agent, Jay Gassner at UTA, who is the best, as you know, and has repped Andy for so long and knows his taste really well and just could see how special this was. So it came in, that was it. Just, would you attach to star in this? And he said, if I can produce it as well and have Becky produce it as well, then yes, would love to. Because we also, the script was so great, but we did want to do a bit of development on it. So it came into us that way. We met with Andy and Max. We loved them. And then we set about doing a few months of development on the script. And then we got it ready to essentially take out as a package and find our financing.
And then how did that go? What, you sent it to everybody and got a lot of passes and that's why it was done independently, or how did that come about?
So we never saw it as a studio movie. So we never went that route. It always was, you know, we thought, yes, we'll do this independently. I had never made a movie at this budget level before. I had only really made studio movies. And we took it out, you know, with UTA, of course, took it out to a number of financiers and had a lot of interest, which was great. Again, it just kind of keeps going back to, I can't say enough good things about the script. And so then we got interest from a company called Limelight, and they came in to finance it. And then we were off to the races.
Do you remember what the primary development you guys did? What was the focus of those months of working on the script?
I sure do. It's interesting, and because you've seen it, I'll say some stuff, of course, but I don't want to spoil other things. We wanted to look a little more closely at the third act. In an old version, in the original version of the script, our two characters who are stuck in this time loop don't even attempt to get out of it. And when Andy and I talked it through, it just felt really organic to what the story and what the characters would do. And it made it a bit of a bigger movie. You know, I think if you're stuck in a time loop and you're really, let's sit in that reality for a moment, you'd try to get out. You know, it's,
oh, I'm trying to get out of this time loop I'm in every day now.
We are all trying so hard. When is this going to be over? I know. It's so, I mean, just the fact that this movie is about what we are in a lot of ways going through right now as a society is such incredible timing. I don't even have the words.
I should say the basic log line of the movie is that Andy Samberg is at a wedding reception at a resort. And what we quickly realize is that this wedding reception, the day of this wedding and wedding reception, is playing over and over and over again. In fact, Andy has been there for several years, stuck in this loop. And then he meets a woman who then quickly realizes that she's now stuck in a loop. So it's a great, big, high concept idea, which leads me to my second question is, why didn't you think it was a studio movie back then?
I think most of it was really the tone of it. It was, you know, you've seen it, so you know, but it is absolutely a romantic comedy in its bones through and through, but it also has this sci-fi twist to it.
Yes.
And it's very grounded. And I will say also, you know, from the sci-fi aspect of it, and this is what, you know, one of the things that we felt like really differentiated it from Groundhog Day, which obviously we all worship and is comedy gold. That was one of the things that we felt like, okay, this is not just a copy of Groundhog Day. It's, you know, somewhat of an homage and also doing it very differently. And the sci-fi element was part of that, you know, and the sci-fi, it's funny. Sometimes when I tell people this, they laugh, but we took it so seriously. I got in touch with a guy. There's a commission. They work with Marvel a lot. So I got to them through my friend who works at Marvel. There's a science and entertainment commission. I don't know if you've ever worked with them, but they connected me with a physicist at USC who Andy and I got on the phone with to talk about the reality of how would you get out of a time loop and wormholes and time travel and things like this. And he actually, that professor, has a cameo in the movie as when our character of Sarah, Kristen Milioti's character, is Skyping with a professor trying to learn about we knew who to cast. So we didn't feel like it was a studio movie really because of the tone. I say this, I come from the studio world. I'm back to doing that now. I say this with all great respect for bigger studio movies. We felt like this one needed nurturing in a different way. We didn't want to get the notes that I've given and I've gotten of potentially, you know, broadening it and maybe diluting it a little bit. We just didn't want to do that. And again, it kind of all goes back to that script having a really specific tone. So it didn't feel like that to us. And that's why we just went right to financiers.
And so when the movie was greenlit and you guys were going to set out to make it, what were, because you guys, I was shocked to learn that it was all shot at a house. It looks like a resort. So what were some of the decisions that went into pre-production when you were thinking about, did you ever think like, oh, let's try to shoot it in Hawaii or let's shoot it in Mexico? Or what went through your mind as you were thinking about the location of this movie?
Sure. Now it feels naive, but at the time I was like, well, yeah, we'll shoot this in Palm Springs and we'll find a great resort that works. And then the budget reality became the budget reality. And, you know, you're backing into a number and it's all resource allocation, of course, but it's also a wedding comedy. So just by virtue of having so many extras and therefore so many fringes in your budget, you know, pension, health and welfare, if I hear those words again, I'm going to like start twitching. You know, it was so closely minding this budget that forced us to not be able to shoot in Palm Springs. We talked about Utah for a second. We talked about Albuquerque and we caught a really big break and we were fortunate enough to get the California tax credit. So that got obviously more money added to our budget and allowed us to sleep in our own beds every day. But we shot as I'm sure you know, when you get the California tax credit and you've been awarded, you can shoot anywhere inside the 30-mile zone, the TMZ of Los Angeles, but there's actually an extension beyond that. So our extension from like a mileage radius perspective allowed us to shoot in Santa Clarita and Palmdale. So we actually only shot this movie for one day in Palm Springs. A story I'll get to down the road, but we had to get creative. You know, when you're making something low budget, you get scrappy. So I love that you think it was shot at a beautiful looking resort. That is a
random
house we found in the middle of nowhere that we were able to kind of cut it together so it looked right.
Was the script always Palm Springs? Was it always set in Palm Springs, this wedding reception?
It was. Inspired by our screenwriter had gotten married there.
Oh, okay.
Our director, they had been through this wedding season of wedding after wedding, which I think for them ultimately started feeling like a time loop also. So that was part of the inspiration. So yeah, it was always Palm Springs and we always loved that title. I still love the title.
It's a great title. And so what was the one day you shot in Palm Springs?
So that was actually, we had to go out to Joshua Tree. It wasn't even like Palm Springs proper, but it was without giving too much away. And I'll get to this because, as you know, I love your podcast. So I know you're going to ask Best Dance at. And that is that day that we shot out.
Well, you can answer it right now. What if this is your best day on set and the one day you shot Joshua Tree, what was it?
Okay, I love it. We're going to combine. We, without giving much away, there is a critical scene in the movie where we needed to get footage of a family. And as I've said, our budget was stretched beyond thin. I mean, I had said to Andy Samberg at one point, I can't spend $250 to get you prescription sunglasses for the underwear. I mean, truly, that is self-strapped to worse. So about a week before production, we're sitting in my office talking through some options for, we know we need to shoot a family, ideally a family of four. And They don't have to say much. It's just going to be one or two lines, but it was footage we thought we might need. It wasn't scripted, but it was regarding the ending and we wanted to get it just in case. So Andy looks at this picture I have on my desk of my family and says, your family's cute. Can you guys do it? Because we need to be really off book. Basically, we couldn't afford to have to pay actors, to have tutors on set for the kids, you know, all of that. It was just, we were so strapped. So my husband, Matt, took the kids out of school, drove 3 hours each way to Joshua Tree so that we could get this footage. And, you know, I wish I could tell you that the best day on set of this movie was any of the days we were shooting it. But it was, we just, this movie was kind of Murphy's Law. Everything that could go wrong was going wrong. We did it. The weather was terrible every day. We were shooting splits. So we were, you know, shooting until 4 in the morning, exhausted. It was freezing cold for some reason in April and May of Los Angeles last year. It was just nuts. So anyway, so Matt brings the kids out to set and we play this family and we get this footage. And it was in the full circle moment of working motherhood and trying to figure out how to find that balance. And then just seeing my kids on set, you know, I had been so absent during the shooting, even though I was sleeping in my bed every day. It was wild in terms of just the hours. So they hadn't seen me much. And just, you know, being able to show them not just what I do, but also all of the people there, you know, lifting this production together. Yeah. So that was great. And that was the one day we shot there.
No, it's nice. What was the budget going in?
They told me not to tell you. I wish I could. I'm sorry. Okay.
I'm assuming it was very reasonable because you are not being able to afford glasses. So I'm sure it was very reasonable.
It was wonderful. Yeah.
And then, so you make the movie, you edit it together, and now you don't have a distributor at this point. You've guys have gone in. Did you do some foreign pre-sales on it?
No, we, wow. No, nothing. So we were going into Sundance, you know, we were even just hopeful to get into Sundance. You know, I hadn't done the film festival thing before at all. As I said, I came up under Marion Scott. We were making studio movies, you know, going to Sundance was not a priority. So I was totally unfamiliar with festivals, with Sundance, especially, had never been. And so, yeah, we went there.
What a first Sundance you had.
I keep joking. I'm never going back.
You can't. You know? You'll just be disappointed. So you get into Sundance and famously the movie, although it's just been lots of different reports about how much it sold for, but it definitely is a record breaker. Walk me through the screening, through the sale. How did that all come about?
It was wild, and it was one of those things that I had read other people's oral histories of their movies, and it started to, I was having almost an out-of-body experience as we were going through the weekend through the sale, because it was feeling so similar to things I had read. But so we don't really have much expectation going in. I have to say, you know, we had killed ourselves to make this movie. It had been really brutal in post. Also, we'd gotten an extension for submitting the movie. We'd gotten an extension for getting them the print. It was
what happened in post that set you back?
It was, you know, I think when you get in the edit, it's always a bit challenging. And as I said, in terms of the tone of the script, it was a really specific, unique tone. And nailing that just right was challenging. So that was part of it. The other part, you know, back to the sci-fi aspect, we had so many visual effects and, you know, ran out of money. And then we put some of our own money in to finish that. It was really, it was just a grind. And it was also, you know, when you make a movie independently, as maybe you know, but I think this is maybe interesting for some of your listeners, your line producer is on, and then they wrap out after 2 weeks, and then you're in post and you have a post-production supervisor. But I really was the joke Andy and I make is we're like holding this thing together with string and paper clips at times. It just, I, you know, I had to educate myself on so much with regard to post-production and that terminology and things where I felt like Denzel Washington in Philadelphia, where he's like, explain this to me like I'm a 2-year-old.
Right.
Just, you know, but again, just work hard and be nice to people and they will help you. So we were able to get through that. So we go to Sundance again, hoping to sell the movie. That is, I don't even mean it to sound like faux humble. We thought we had something special, but who the fuck knows? So we go, and it was really, it was a nice time. We had a great press day that Saturday with Andy and Kristen Milioti, who stars as Sarah, and Camila Mendez, who is playing her sister, the bride, in the movie, and she's wonderful, and our buddy Meredith Hagner, and, you know, just all the people who are in the movie. I can't say enough good things about all of these actors. So that was fun. And then Sunday comes around, and we're premiering that Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Library Theater. And we are, you know, getting a little nervous, and we're all eating lunch in the basement of a restaurant in Park City. And it's the basement, so there's no cell reception. And Andy goes upstairs to, I think, check his phone, and comes back downstairs and looks at like he's seen a ghost. And he said, Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter crash. And we are... so we're all so shaken by this news. I'm from Philadelphia, as I told you. I'm like devastated, and as is the world. And so we sort of quickly compartmentalize this. We're very sad, but, you know, we kind of put on game faces, and we go to the premiere, and it premieres, and the energy in the room you could feel was, it was great. You know, we'd never, of course, screened it for an audience this large, but I had never been to Sundance, as I said, but I could, you know, I could just feel something special was happening. And I had Phil Raskin sitting on my left next to me, which was just like a nice full circle moment for my career. And so the curtain comes up, and the movie, you know, the movie ends, and I have people kind of coming up and like squeezing my shoulder, like, that was really good. And so we started to get an inkling of, we felt more confident at that point that we will probably sell this, but we go, and on our way to the after party, some of the reviews start coming in just via Twitter, but from journalists who were in the room, and everyone is loving this movie. And so we're pinching ourselves and kind of can't believe it. And we go to this after party, and I keep getting pulled out into the freezing cold with no coat to huddle with our team because offers are starting to come in. And that's where it becomes very surreal and a bit of a blur. But that then went all through the night. We had meetings, again, sort of the stuff you hear about in other people's stories, of, okay, come to the UTA condo and we're going to bring in these people for a meeting, and then these people, and then these people, and then we're going to talk. And, you know, I have to say UTA did an incredible job. But we were up until 4 or 5 in the morning as the number just kept getting ratcheted up. And finally, it ended for us around 4 or 5. And it was Andy and I standing in like a tiny laundry room closet of this condo we were staying in. And when we got, you know, the news that we would go with Neon and Hulu for this at this unbelievable price tag.
So great. You know what? It always ends up in some little weird room.
Right? I know.
Kathleen was telling me when he sold the movie to Harvey, that when he got the biggest set sale at the time at $10 million, he was in a parking garage.
Right.
It's like it never is like what you think. It's going to be some grand ballroom. No, I'm in a fucking closet.
I was in a closet. My phone, you know, so Andy and I could both hear it, is on speakerphone on an ironing board standing between us in like truly a closet. So, but they were, you know, with stuff like that. And when that price tag is getting ratcheted up so much, and everyone's managing it so carefully, and we're all exhausted, and it was, I remember really clearly, one of the agents on the phone said, if you are not Andy, Becky, and anyone on this phone call, you do not know this information. You know, it was, do not tell a soul. Right. So we, you know, got an hour of sleep. We were going home the next day. So we truly like slept for an hour, and then the story was breaking on deadline. It was exciting. It was quite an experience.
Beyond the price tag, what made you go with the people you went with? What is the expectation that they have? How are they going to release it? What was the kicker for you guys? Because there's so many different ways to release this kind of movie right now. What was it that made you guys go with Neon and Hulu?
So, for, you know, I have to say, back to just gut instinct, they were so clearly passionate in the way that we were passionate about our movie, and in a way that didn't feel false. It didn't feel like the stuff you say just to land it. I think they really got it. Neon, of course, you know, they've had an incredible year with Parasite, but you know, Tom Quinn at Neon is a special kind of executive, and he really made us feel like he got the movie, he understood how to release it. And this was, again, I know we'll talk about the COVID of it all, but this was back in the days when that wasn't, you know, it was on the horizon, but we didn't know it. So we felt really comfortable and confident working with Tom, and then with everyone at Hulu. You know, Hulu, much like Amazon the year before at Sundance, when they bought Late Night and Britney Runs a Marathon and these huge sales, it felt like that's what Hulu was trying to do this year and really make a statement. And Hulu also just has great taste. And so that was a big incentive for us. So, you know, this movie that we had nurtured and protected for close to 2 years, we took really seriously. We didn't just want, you know, highest bidder. It really came down to, we believe you are the right partners to release this out into the world in the way that we would want it to be. And so that's really into it.
And so now with COVID and everything, what is the plan for the movie?
Sure. So this was, I mean, the roller coaster of this has been really interesting. We get back from Sundance and we hadn't even talked about real release dates before. We'd sort of, you know, maybe this is a summer movie, maybe this is better in the fall, and sort of a smart date night movie. We weren't sure. There were just these conversations in the ether, and then quarantine and COVID hits, and we're still a little bit at that point kicking the can down the road, like, okay, we'll figure this out. Because as you, I'm sure, remember, those early weeks of quarantine, who knew what was on the horizon, really? And so it really wasn't until probably April that we felt like, okay, we have to have some real discussions of, are we holding this and going to still release it at some point in theaters and of course on Hulu, or are we kind of just going to have the come to Jesus and sober discussion amongst ourselves of, this may last for much longer than any of us are predicting or want it to, of course, and it may not get the release we were hoping for. And that's really where we are. And it will be with Neon at drive-ins, and that's where it is. So they were great partners in figuring out what the right date was for doing that, but they were also great partners in when we said, I think we have to call it, guys. You know, I don't think that holding this and hoping for the best is going to make us, yeah, let's do a release this fall. You know, everything just, it was, again, just instinct of, we wanted our baby out in the world in the best way. But, you know, when the wrinkle comes your way, you just figure out how to work with it.
It's going to do so great on that. It really will. It's such a great movie. And it will find its audience and it'll be so well received. It's going to be amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. We have the highest of hopes for it and couldn't be more excited about it and just proud.
It's such a great movie. And I'm making a movie for Hulu with our friend Meredith. So this conversation has indeed come full circle.
I love it. She told me. I love it.
Okay. So what is the new company now? So now you've done this movie. It's going to be out in the world in July on Hulu.
Yeah.
What are you doing now going forward?
So I have recently launched this new company with MRC that is going to focus solely on female-driven comedies and I am sort of partnered with MRC. You know, they're certainly my parent company and partner, but what's cool about this new venture for me is it's a bit of a rubber meets the road of my experience cumulatively coming together, because it's sort of part studio executive and part producer. So again, all female driven. But you know, the mandate for me is to make 2 to 4 movies a year. And on some of them, I will be really granular, boots on the ground, on set every day, producing like we do. And on some of them, I'll be more studio executive oversight and working with producers. I'm working with our good mutual friend, Jen Todd, on something. You know, the excitement to me of being able to, when launching something new and having a ton of autonomy, is seeking out working with people that I want to work with, and you know, relationships over the years, but also just writers and directors and actors who are, you know, incredibly talented and work well in this space. So at this point, Slovater Comedy, what the fuck, is my alt title. It's been wild launching this, you know, basically from my bedroom half the time, when my kids keep walking in saying, "Mom, I'm hungry." And when I say I'm on an important call, they hear, "Please interrupt," 17 times. But I'm deeply grateful. And to be able to launch this just as I'm coming off of Palm Springs is exciting and really special.
And I'm excited because now I have somebody I can bring more material to. We can actually work with somebody I genuinely like. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome. Thank you. I'm so happy for you. And I really am excited for the movie and for everybody to see the movie. And right now it'll be out by the when this comes out. And so Congratulations to you and the team for making the movie, and congratulations on your new company. And I really look forward to working with you. I'm going to find something to bring you shortly, for sure.
I can't wait. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This was so much fun. I loved it.
You're the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use #Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.